Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. One of the countries with which the United States has the most complicated relations, friend or foe, or what kind of mix and with what implications for terrorism in the U.S. and elsewhere, is Pakistan. And with me now is Farah Isfahani, a global fellow at the Wilson Center and former member of the Pakistani Parliament. She has a new book called Purifying the Land of the Pure, A History of Religious Minorities in Pakistan. It explores how the country's departure from its secular roots has affected the lives of religious minorities living there. And, of course, religious strife in Pakistan has implications for U.S. national security, too, and more. Farah, welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure.
By way of background about you for our listeners, I see you were a journalist for 20 years before deciding to join the National Assembly of Pakistan in 2008. Why did you decide to switch to politics?
Well, I've always, I think journalism and politics have a lot in common in terms of conveying views. And I use my time in journalism to really hone my voice in terms of the pro-democracy movement in Pakistan. And I worked informally with the former Prime Minister, Benazir Bhutto, and returned with her to Pakistan for the restoration of democracy.
Pakistan is one of very few countries, along with maybe Iran and Saudi Arabia and Israel, to be officially religious states. It was founded in the 1940s as separate from India for that reason?
Yes, it was founded on the basis of there was a feeling by Mr. Jinnah, the founder, and many Muslims in India that once the British left, that it would be a very difficult relationship to be in a Hindu-majority country without the buffer of the British colonial power. So yes, it was absolutely designed to be a homeland for Muslims.
And do you think that has pushed the country in a more religiously radical direction? That is, if a country is founded on the basis of being a religious/political state, does that create a context by which religious extremists can take more power?
This is such a complicated but excellent question. I think Mr. Jinnah was a Muslim and he understood Muslim politics, but he wanted a Muslim majority country, but a secular state, which is a complicated thought, but that was his thought. And I do feel that had he lived past the first year of Pakistan's founding in 1947, we would have had a chance. But, you know, he did say that he felt Pakistan to be happy and prosperous. Every person living in the country, quote, no matter what is his color, caste or creed, should be first, second and last a citizen of the state with equal rights, privileges and obligations. Unfortunately, almost immediately after his death, the very religious parties and clerics who had opposed Pakistan starting taking over. And this marriage of politics and religion started to take place.
Any Pakistanis, Pakistani-Americans listening right now want to call in for Farah Isfahani, global fellow at the Wilson Center, former member of the Pakistani Parliament. Her new book, Purifying the Land of the Pure, A History of Religious Minorities in Pakistan, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 on the domestic there or international implications, 212-433-9692. And Muslims, if I have my stats right, are about 98% of the population.
Yes, today they are, Brian, but it wasn't always that way. The most shocking, I think, and horrifying statistic that I found in my research was at the time of 47, a mere 70-something years ago, when Pakistan was created, Pakistan had 23% non-Muslims. Mm. Today, it's less than 3%.
Where'd they all go?
So that's the question. And it's what I sort of call informally a drip-drip genocide. And one of the things I think which is pertinent not only to Pakistan, where you see from Mr. Jinnah's vision, a little opening up to religion in the state has led to a jihadi-dominated culture in a lot of ways, where it is unsafe for people like myself and my husband to even live. Not just because of the old days, it used to be the military regime, it used to be jail cells. But as Benazir Bhutto said to me, the time we went back when she was assassinated by her jihadi, that now in Pakistan, there are no longer jail cells. There's just death.
Hmm. What was your and your husband's story? How did you run afoul of the authorities?
Well, my husband has had a long and complicated situation with the Pakistani establishment, as we call it, because of exactly the whole fact of wanting civilians to have more power and to have the military and the establishment crack down on the sponsorship of these jihadi extremist groups. So I work on the flip side of it, which is that the fact that Pakistan today is no longer a pluralistic state, is no longer a place that houses Hindus and Christians and Zoroastrians and Ahmadi Muslims and, you know, all of those people in the numbers that it had, is because to a large part, the mixing of religion and politics and the sponsorship of these extremist jihadi groups by the Pakistani establishment.
What are the roles, if any, for the United States in the internal discrimination that you're talking about? And does it relate to how the U.S. usually thinks of Pakistan, which is a place where Osama bin Laden was, you know, a place that supports the Taliban, a place that indirectly presents risk of terrorism to Americans?
Well, the United States has, how do I put this politely, but not been highly intelligent in its treatment of Pakistan, unfortunately. And not just for Pakistan and Pakistanis like myself, but for America. And this has been something that we have been trying to get out to the world, that, you know, the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom, USIRF, which is an autonomous but congressionally funded body in Washington, D.C., it has recommended year after year to the State Department that Pakistan, you know, must be declared a state at the highest level, a state that is a very dangerous place for people of religious minority faiths. But year after year, the State Department has ignored those recommendations. And going back in history, when you look at Zia-ul-Haq, when the United States wanted to go into Afghanistan in the 80s, we had our worst military dictator. But the United States turned a blind eye to Saudi Arabia, its co-partner in the fight, you know, with the Mujahideen against the Soviets. And so they allowed the Saudis to come in, as did the Pakistani leadership, build madrasas all over Pakistan and bring in this Wahhabi Islam, which was not intrinsically known to our region.
So the U.S., you're saying, could have been tougher on Pakistan, calling it a state that persecutes its own religious minorities more clearly over time. But could that have had an impact, or would that have just caused a backlash among the growing jihadi majority?
Initially, when we're going back in time, the United States was the only game in town for Pakistan. Now, because I think U.S. diplomacy has really not played a valuable role. Now you have China, you have Russia, you have Iran. There are many other people to support Pakistan.
And do you think the U.S. could have prevented the Saudi radical Wahhabis, who you're just talking about? I guess Osama bin Laden would be one of them himself, yes. Saudi guy who went to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan and wound up sort of straddling Afghan and Pakistani politics with his brand of radicalism. Could the U.S. have influenced Saudi Arabia to stop that early on or not really?
I think in the 80s, the U.S. and the Saudis were partnered. And the problem is that the U.S., in that case and even today, has always looked at short-term military fixes for not just Pakistan, but I think the region. And that has actually come home to bite the United States and to hurt U.S. citizens. So it has been a very simple-minded, I would say, strategy.
Is there a Trump policy toward Pakistan that you can discern yet? That's either the same or any different from an Obama policy?
We don't really know what policy there will be, because in Washington, as where I live at the moment, there's no policy on anything. So it's a very confusing time for foreign policy. And so it's a very bad time for people who have causes or who believe in anything, because the White House has not settled down yet into any discernible pattern.
Kaisar in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Kaisar.
Hello, Ryan. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Hi to your guest. Her name kind of slipped my mind. Brian,
her name is Farah Isfahan.
I love listening to your show, and I find it very objective and extremely knowledgeable. I was listening to the opening comment of your audience. I'm from Pakistan. I'm from the north of Pakistan, from Peshawar. And I was listening to her assessment regarding towards destabilization factor and radical element and the takeover of the fundamental religious element in Pakistan after the death of Qaeda Azam, whom she referred to as Mr. Jinnah. So obviously she does not acknowledges the founding father as Qaeda Azam, but that's irrelevant.
What's your question?
My question is that she fails to identify the fact that it was never about the religious issue in Pakistan after the death. It was always about the central power, which Punjabis always controlled. It was the Northern Promise and the other promise that said the Balochistan were the element of radicalization, as they call it conveniently, that they were radicalized. No, they were misused. They were abused. They were never given a proper role in government, and they were always on the front line of suffering.
Kaisar, I'm going to leave it there and get a response. You know, it's happened many places and many times in world history that what looks to outsiders like a religious dispute is really a dispute over geography or representation. And then people become radicalized and seize on religion as a source of either emotional refuge or political refuge and political power development. I think that's what he's alleging here.
I would greatly disagree. And Qaeda Azam, which means the great leader, Mr. Jinnah, actually, my grandfather was one of his closest colleagues and was actually Pakistan's first ambassador to Washington right after Pakistan was founded. So I have hold Mr. Jinnah, the Qaeda Azam, in the greatest esteem. The caller is trying to muddy a conversation on religion with his grief, which I can understand, about a certain ethnic group. But I do not think that has anything to do with what I call the drip-drip genocide of Pakistan's minorities who have been wiped out. So he's bringing together a topic which is really is not the subject of my book. And just for his understanding, Islam was brought in by the first prime minister of Pakistan, Mr. Liaquat Ali Khan, in the form of the Objectives Resolution in 1949, in which it was basically said that Islam was the official religion and that all minority groups would be treated equally under the edicts of Islam. So that we start off by having non-equal citizens.
But drip, 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 it hasn't worked out.
Drip, 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 you have a genocide.
Does the war in Afghanistan, now in its 17th year, in its current form, affect what's going on in Pakistan? This is another thing that Donald Trump will have to get his mind around as president, in his nationalist, not wanting to do nation-building stance, but also wanting to win around the world. What kind of military troop surge, as I think some of his generals want, or maybe saying, you know, enough of all that and let's leave Afghanistan to the Afghan people. Do you have an opinion one way or the other as to the relative merits of more or less involvement in Afghanistan going future and does going further, and does it affect religious freedom in Pakistan?
There's an absolute correlation, and there always has been. The Pakistani establishment, its support for these jihadi extremist groups who kill and have led to the marginalization and indeed elimination of most minority groups, has been because of their support of these groups. But these groups, why did they come into existence? They came into existence to fight wars that the military wanted, to fight wars in Afghanistan, in India, etc. So the Taliban in Pakistan, its biggest supporter are these jihadi groups trained in Pakistan. So yes, the US should have a troop surge, even though I am very against war, but even if it's for keeping the peace, because the Pakistanis have to be pushed back and the Pakistani state has to look after its own people.
So without the kind of stalemate war that we have now, this mm-hmm. kind of hold what they've got, with the Taliban controlling about a third of the country, as I understand it, you think the Taliban, with support from the Pakistani Taliban, would overrun it and it would become even more of a jihadi radical state, and that would produce international terrorism risk?
It is already overrun. And basically, the Pakistanis try to tell people that there's a difference between all these groups. But very frankly, they all work as one or as another, depending on what their mission is.
Very quickly, because we just have 20 seconds. I see your book has not been published in Urdu. Does that matter?
Of course it matters. The book is available in Pakistan in English. I am looking for a publisher in Urdu, but I would fear for that publisher's life.
Pressure against that publication holding it down.
No, not pressure. Death. That's what they do in Pakistan now.
Farah Isfahani, Global Fellow at the Wilson Center, former member of the Pakistani Parliament, author now of Purifying the Land of the Pure, A History of Religious Minorities in Pakistan. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.